Welcome back to another episode of the Authors Unite Show. Here's your host, Tyler Wagner.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Authors Unite Show. Today, I have Al Moreno with us. So welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tyler, for having me on.
Of course. Grateful to have you here. So, if you can, start off and tell us a little bit more about you and what you do.
Well, I'm a former United States Marine, served in Vietnam in 1968-69 as a rifleman and a radio man. Got back and applied for the LAPD. Took me only 5 years to get on. Was fighting a lot of disqualifications back then. They weren't hiring a lot of people of color and women. And once I got on, I did really well. Then after the situation that I had with the department, I went on to become a private investigator. Then I authored LA's Last Street Cop.
Gotcha. Okay. And so tell me a little bit like about your experience of like being a cop. How long were you a cop?
I was on the department for just a little under 7 years before I was fired by a corrupt internal affairs investigation and Board of Rights.
Okay, tell us more about that. What happened?
At the last 4 years on the job, the LAPD started their first ever gang suppression unit to work East Los Angeles and South Central. The gang shootings and wars that had been going on forever, and the community was just going completely crazy over this thing. The federal government stepped in and basically wrote a blank check for the LAPD to get 40 or select 40 officers from the entire department to work the unit. And so I was one of the 40 officers picked. And we worked Central Bureau, which encompasses part of East Los Angeles, where actually East LA and South Central, where most of the gang wars were occurring. And on a regular day, we would handle anywhere from 1 to 3 shootings per night. And that went on for 4 years, as many as 5 then it resulted in homicides. So we got pretty good at what we were doing. Yeah. However, the 40 officers versus 450 gangs with anywhere from, depends on who you listen to, anywhere from 50 to 75,000 gang members. I mean, the math wasn't just there. So we were doing a great job. However, we just didn't have the personnel and budget to do really, what needed to be done. We should have, that unit should have been at least a divisional size of 200 officers if they were really serious about it.
Gotcha.
So the crime statistics were going through the ceiling. You know, the city fathers, the business owners, property owners were, bitching at the mayor, and the mayor was bitching at the city council. City council was, coming down on the chief of police. It rolled downhill to our unit commander. And what he did is that he started cooking the books, rewriting what constituted a gang-related crime. And it got so bad that half the unit transferred out because of the lack of integrity and honesty, to the community and to themselves. Well, I was crushing it, and I stayed. And at one point, I just couldn't take any longer, so I did what they call whistleblowing these days. And I went to the commander, Mark Croker, that was in charge of all 5 divisions in Central Bureau. Told him the whole story, and he goes, Al, we know what was going on, but we never had anybody that was, courageous enough to come and tell us and pretty well put their, their career on the line. Then he asked me if there was any supervisors or anybody else that would back up my story. And I said, well, there were 4, and 2 of them were just absolutely fabulous supervisors, sergeants. And they went to basically before the commander and basically verified everything I said. So then there was word that there was going to be a board of inquiry, which meant that heads were going to roll because everybody knew what was going on and now they had the evidence. And at that time, I was working homicide and I got beeped up on a drive-by murder where a 14 or 15-year-old gang member and his brother was the head of La Emma in the joint in prison. And anyhow, he and 2 other shooters cut this 60-year-old kid in half of the sawed off. And I knew the Aguirre family from the Avenues gang, and I had arrested them before. And so when I got beefed up on the murder, I got to the homicide scene, and we couldn't get a hold of my partner. That's when we had beepers. That was before cell phones, obviously. And so this new guy that came into the unit wasn't pretty well of the character caliber, excuse me, that, you know, most of the guys that left the unit, because, you know, the word got out that it wasn't a good unit to work for. To make a long story short, well, we arrested one of the three shooters, the main shooter with a sawed-off 12-gauge shotgun. And while we were interviewing, I played the good guy, bad guy routine. I grab him by the lapels, and then I push him towards his chair. Then I go storming out of the room like I was losing my temper. And this is where my partner normally steps up and goes, hey, you know, you're really pissed off, Marino. You're gonna get 30 years on this year. Cooperate with us. Well, I waited about 5 minutes, you know, outside the interview room. And this new guy comes out and he goes, you know, Marina, you physically assaulted that arrestee under color of authority, and I'm going to the old man with it. Well, he knew that me and the lieutenant were at war, and there was a detective three spot coming up. So, you know, he said that that I had, you know, put my hands on the suspect. And 2 weeks later, me and a group of LAPD coppers from LAPD and Pomona PD went to the Colorado River for a water skiing trip for a weekend. And one of the places that we went, one of the nights that we were there, was a place that we hadn't gone to before. It was called the Moonshine Bar, just along the river there. And when we walked in, it turned out to be a white supremacist bar with members from the Aryan Brotherhood that were hanging out there. So there were a couple of people on our party that weren't cops, and they had already started, you know, buying drinks. So we said, well, we're going to have a drink and get the hell out of here. And just as we started leaving, this one monster, Jerry Hallam, AKA the Skull Crusher, just paroled from prison for cutting his wife's fingers off with an axe, an active member of the Aryan Brotherhood. The guy was 6'4", 260, he was a monster. As we're leaving the bar, I was tailing Charlie. He grabs me, wheels me around, and is gonna take my head off. So I went into him like a buzzsaw. The fight was on. After the fight, he ran out to his truck and got a sawed-off shotgun and came at us. We didn't have time to get in our boats, and we jumped in the river and, you know, got the hell out of there. So the department got this allegation of pushing the gang member and defending ourselves against this shotgun-wielding animal, and incorporated a investigation of internal affairs. And at the very outset of the internal affairs investigation, they were overheard by one of their secretaries that they said that we're going to fry Marino's ass. So, I mean, you know, it was already a done deal. They were getting rid of me. And then a week after that, the advocate that was going to put on the case for the board that works for internal affairs was heard by another, actually a training officer that I used to have that became a sergeant, was internal affairs, went to internal affairs, and he stated in a declaration that, you know, Marino's going to get fired regardless of the evidence. So anyhow, a central trial board and fired. But the really striking thing, or one of the very striking things about it, is that when internal affairs investigated this animal over in Ontario, the Aryan Brotherhood, he told them to their face that he was going to murder Officer Marino. And he found out where I worked through a friendship of his with some ex-cons from La M, which is the Mexican mafia. And as soon as he found me, he was going to kill me. The LAPD has a standard protocol that they do when they have that type of a credible threat. They get Metro to sit in front of your house and your parents' house for 24/7, robbery, homicide, conducts an investigation, SIS follows the guy, and none of that was done. That's the first time in LAPD history that has ever happened. In essence, the Los Angeles Police Department sanctioned the Aryan Brotherhood to murder one of their own. I have the documents, and it's in the book.
Wow, that's I have so many questions. I was looking over here. Yeah. So, like, but to kind of close the loop on this, in a sense, like, do you think that the mob or the mafia, are they still currently potentially wanting to kill you? Like, are you kind of like on hideout?
Well, it's you know, this was some time ago, and I can't answer you why the hit wasn't done, because because it happened in Yuma County, Colorado River.
Yeah.
And the their intel unit for Yuma County Sheriff's Department that handled the, you know, the aftermath of the fight, they called me personally at my house, and then they called the chief's office and told him that they have information that confirms that this guy is going to murder me. And I have, and you know, all these statements are in the LAPD documents, because if I didn't have those statements, nobody would believe the story in a million years, because it's just completely wacko.
Yeah.
But I just, you know, I can't answer you why at least an attempt murder wasn't done. I don't know why.
Yeah.
So I, you know, however, for the first 2 years, I was sitting out in front of my mom's house, armed to the teeth, scared to death, because I thought they were going to come in and, you know, just wipe out my family.
Yeah, no, I would have. Yeah, I can't even imagine. So, wow. All right. So this is going to be a wild podcast. Here we go. So let's go to, well, yeah, let's kind of start from the beginning and then work our way back up to current. So, you are one of 12 children. Can you kind of just give us a glimpse of, like, what was that like growing up, one of 12 in an 874 square foot house?
Well, I think that just the way you phrase that, if you get actually a total of 14 people at one point in a home under 800 square feet, where the bathroom was so small that when you opened the door, it actually struck the toilet bowl. And it was, you know, that thing's got a Guinness Book of Records of flushes. I can guarantee you that. But we were the poorest family on the block. And we didn't eat, like, you know, we're hungry a lot. And I mean, Dad was busting his butt, but, you know, wasn't really making any money. Yeah. And then we were raised right, you know, in ground zero of Florencia 13, which is one of the most lethal Hispanic gangs that go back to the 20s. So it was, I mean, I seen my first homicide before I was in the first grade. It was a stabbing. It was really gross. So it was tough. It was really tough.
That's crazy. So wait, so now but did both of your parents work? It's just they couldn't find, I guess, good work essentially?
Well, Mom worked 24/7. She had 12 kids.
Oh, yeah, good point. Yeah, yeah. I overlooked that. Yeah, she had a full-time job plus another full-time job.
Yeah.
For sure. And then what did your dad do?
Dad worked as a truck driver for a company in Van Nuys. He's working 6 days a week. But, you know, no insurance. You know, 1 week's vacation, and it was, you know, it was really a really very lean, challenging time for not only myself, but all my other brothers and sisters.
Gotcha. And then just so I know where the Florencia or whatever, where is that actually, like, located?
It's just east, it borders Watts. So just actually about a quarter mile east of us is Watts proper, where at that time, you know, you talk about the 50s and 60s, it was 99%, you know, Afro-American. And the little enclave that I lived into was principally Hispanic. So there were these gang wars going on. You know, it was just insane. You know, you can hear gunshots, you know, cops rolling. It was awful.
That is crazy. So, okay. So then, you know, obviously you have your whole childhood, which, you know, seems pretty wild. And then you decide to enlist in the Marines, and then you actually went and you fought in the Vietnam War.
Correct.
Well, first, thank you for your service. Can you tell us, like, that's another, you know, just wild. So what was that like?
I can tell you about my first day. It'll take maybe 2 minutes if that's okay.
Oh, yeah, we got time.
Okay. So anyhow, when we first went to boot camp, MCRD in San Diego, and then as we filtered through ITRB, IT Staging Battalion, then we went to Vietnam, there were 20 of us of the original 300 that started in boot camp. So I knew these guys really well. The 20 of us went to this, we landed in Da Nang on February the 23rd, 1969, dead in the middle of the Tet Offensive of 1969. And so we were hustled into this big kind of like a warehouse, and then we were individually sent to various units. So we waited for a Rough Rider for about an hour and a half, which took us to our battalion headquarters, Hill 10. And when we arrived, it was kind of like lunchtime. And so they said, you know, go over to the chow hall before we give you your, you know, your weapons, your M16s, your M79 grenade launchers, your M60s, that sort of thing. And so we're in the chow hall, and I get these, they had these big trays, and we all kind of just, you know, truncated to like we were back in boot camp. We went shoulder to shoulder going down this chow line, and this one guy looked at me, and I think I looked so pathetic that he poured this extra scoop of goop on my tray. And just then, we took 140 and 122 millimeter rockets. It was incoming. And I, you know, we were in Vietnam, maybe, Christ, I don't know, 2.5 hours. So we're taking these incoming rounds and everybody, poof, they're gone. They're out of the shell hole. I panicked one time in Vietnam. And that was that first day. Everybody was out of the chow hall. My feet were cemented to the ground and I was hyperventilating. And the whole time you could hear these terrific explosions. You could actually hear the shrapnel slapping through different parts of, you know, structures and what have you. And then it dawned on me, I better get the hell out of there. So as opposed to just dropping my tray, I fling it straight up in the air. I don't know why I did that. I think about it now, I kind of laugh at it, but I rocketed out of there and I'm just flying down the hill, and there's these bunkers and foxholes, but I wasn't jumping into any of them. Psychologically, what I was doing, I was running back home. I figured that out later. And anyhow, at one point I says, what the hell's going on? So I jumped inside this hole, and there were six Marines tightly squeezed in, three on one side and three on the other. And I somehow kind of like just embedded myself in between these three Marines. And they, I mean, these guys looked like everything you'd see on a giant hunting movie. They just look badass. So I was sitting there and the rounds are just exploding. And then I'm thinking to myself, well, what if one of the rounds hits on this side of the bunker? So I unsqueezed myself, went into the other two Marines and did the same thing. Then I had the same thought. And then I went back to the other, and one of the Marines looks at me and goes, you know, I can't use the language that they use, but you know, if you do that again, he says, if the incoming doesn't kill us, I'm going to kill you. So I said, okay, fine. Anyhow, after the barrage, we all kind of like get out of the hole, and two of the 20 guys that we were with were blown all to hell. They didn't even try any, they were about maybe 25 feet from me, and they were putting them on this little, what we call a mule, kind of little like a red wagon with a little motor on it that they use on the hill. And they plopped what was remaining of their completely torn apart bodies. And it was, you know, the reality of that was just phenomenal. Anyhow, after that, they take us to the armory where they were going to issue us our various weapons. And the guy says, okay, just hold on for a few minutes here. And then we see another mule coming towards us. And it's got a mountain of stuff on it. Well, what it was a 782 gear, helmets, flak jackets, web belts from guys that had just been killed or severely wounded. And it still had tissue, bone, holes in the middle, and it was shocking. And the guy just kind of like kicks the load of that gear over, and he says, grab it, go over there and wash it out. And so we all just kind of like were froze standing there, and then we just like a bunch of mad dogs ran towards it to get the flak jackets and helmets with the least bit of bone tissue and blood on it, and we washed it off. And then they gave us, after we washed it off, they gave us all of one magazine. I mean, this is the United States Marine Corps, for God's sakes. They said, well, we'll issue the other, you're supposed to get 20, you know, in a couple of days. When it was the middle of a Tet and all the guys were out, so they didn't have anything for us. So that was my first day in Vietnam.
That is How long were you there?
I was there just around 4 months. Then I got medevaced back home.
So do you, have you experienced any, like, what is it called, PTSD? From, like, just all
You know, it's, I was born to be a warrior. You know, I was a gladiator back in, you know, protecting my brothers and sisters back in the hood. I always wanted to become a policeman. The war was kind of like what I, you know, it was kind of like the John Wayne. I was born, you know, when they had all the John Wayne war movies and stuff like that, but it was, you know, radically different in real life. No, I haven't. I never really experienced that. I just was blessed to be able to absorb that horror and, you know, live a productive life.
Wow. So, all right. So, yeah, let's talk about the current situation we have. what are your overall thoughts on what is currently, you know, going on with, I mean, the media is showing it every day. I think it, you know, kind of started with the George Floyd thing. And then now, like, do you have any thoughts on the whole situation?
Well, you know, Tyler, I go back to, I'm 74.
Yeah.
And I go back to the Watts riots in 1965. And I actually, we lived in the curfew zone. Mm-hmm. And so I've experienced that. And then the 1992 riots and then these riots. But, you know, the central question in this particular case is that, you know, this nut that this officer that was, you know, after the suspect was handcuffed and he had his knee over the top of his cervical spine for, I think it's like 8 minutes and 47. I mean, that's repugnant to every police officer, male and female, that I have ever met. And I know a lot of cops because I've been all through the U.S. in my investigations. And, you know, you meet cops and you talk to them. And I'm talking from my personal experience. And when I was working gangs for the last 4 years, we were fighting all the time. And we were dealing with kids that were extremely volatile, armed to the teeth. And so there was a lot of fighting going on, but I don't ever recall any of us after one of these hellacious fights that we had on the street, seemed like every other day, were once you handcuff a suspect, you get him in the car and you get the hell out of there. So I just, I don't have an answer. And I must have watched that video, God's truth, at least 6 or 7 times before I could actually manage to watch the entire almost 9 minutes. It was like chewing and swallowing nails for me.
Yeah.
I love the character of our law enforcement, men and women, and they are truly the best of the best. And it's not a few good cops. In my personal experience, 95% at least. I'm talking from my personal experience, and I worked in 7 divisions.
Yeah.
However, I just, you know, when you, then you look at the other officers that were standing there, you know, now I got a little more information. I understand that 2 of them had just been out of the academy in like, you know, just a few days. So for them to look at this one guy that had like, I don't know, 17, 18 years on the job, the guy that was the copper that was standing over the, or kneeling over the top of this gentleman. Yeah. I could see where a probationer would be so cowed, so shocked to dare tell his training officer, hey man, get off his neck. That's a tough one. That's a tough one. Yeah. It really is.
No, yeah, it really is. So what are your thoughts on like, so I don't know, I saw this morning, I think it's Minneapolis or it's Minnesota, I think it's Minneapolis.
Yeah, Minneapolis, yeah.
Yeah, they're saying like defund the police. Like I guess so. Look, I think we can all agree that the George Floyd thing was very wrong. Like, I don't know.
It doesn't get any worse than that. Does not.
Yeah, agreed. So, but I guess I'm just curious as to, like, well, is defunding the police the solution? I mean, then what's going to happen? So then in that area, there will be no policing? That doesn't seem like a good idea to me.
Well, the areas in the United States that need the police, the response, care, and sacrifice that the police do 24/7 for these communities that are advocating this insanity are the very ones that need the police the most. Mm-hmm. But it's a political thing right now, and they're trying to placate whatever the hell the mindset is right now, and they're coming out with these loon ideas of defund. I mean, LAPD has already cut back $120 million on support for our police officers. Other cities are talking about actually completely abolishing law enforcement and incorporating something like what they called the guardian angels. I don't know, you don't probably go back that far, but there was this one kind of well-intended guy where they wore these little berets and kind of red shirts, unarmed citizens patrolling the street, kind of like a quasi sort of law enforcement. Are they advocating for that? I have no idea, but from my personal experience, this is going to be just a watershed for all of these thugs that we have in these cities that are just going to butcher the people. Within 90 days, all the wheels will come off. I can guarantee you that.
Yeah, so, yeah, it doesn't seem, yeah, I don't think defund the police. In fact, right now, I feel like, just truthfully, maybe more police, but I that's just what it seems to me. Like, because the whole, like, look, I nothing to me wrong with protesting. I think, look, something, there was an injustice needs to happen, but the looting and burning things down, I mean, I don't see how that's actually helping anything. I've seen some interviews where people are saying, like, no peace until justice. So, like, they basically see it as they're going to burn things down and loot until justice in it. But it's like, well, we have to define, like, what is justice served? I feel like justice kind of was served for that. Like, the guy's in jail, I think it's second degree murder right now.
This isn't Moscow, Peking, Tehran, or Penguin John. This is the United States of America. And even the most dreadful characters have the constitutional right to get sent through the process of being indicted, arrested, going through a jury trial. And these things take time, Tyler. They take time. Now, the individuals that were involved in this horrific incident, they've been arrested. And so it's going to be this thing could take years. It could take years. And so no peace, no justice, no peace. The process and the wheels have been radically, you know, fast forwarded in this particular case. And for the first time ever, from at least my personal experience, the officers that were not involved, I mean, physically involved, that were looking, they got indicted. I've never seen that before. I don't know how that's going to fare. I don't believe there's any case law that they can really cite in something like that. I'm not defending the lack of those two young probationers.
Yeah.
It's going to be a whole different paradigm from now on. It's not only a phenomenon here in the United States, but it's around the world, and it's coloring our law enforcement in such a dreadful, ugly way. And that's not the case of these. You know, Tyler, every year statistically, there are 430 interactions with law enforcement in the public throughout the United States. 240 are from radio calls, when somebody calls the cops and they go talk to somebody, and 190 are from like traffic stops or tickets and what have you.
Yeah.
The statistics for that is that when officers use deadly force, the statistic for that is 0.0002293. Virtually non-existent if you crunch the numbers in that fashion and you look at the population of 328 million Americans, you don't have to fear our law enforcement. You don't. They're there to serve you. Now, am I saying that there aren't dreadful things that occur? Of course they have. And am I saying that there aren't some policemen that should be on the job? I'm not saying that either. They pick from the human pool. And the human pool is, well, I mean, that's all we got. But, you know, as hard as they push through, and for I can talk for LA, you know, there were six different tests that you took to get onto the LAPD. One of them was the psychological test, the Rorschach test, and the Minnesota Multi-Basic Personality Test. You talk to the shrink, and it's a comprehensive background. And I mean, I don't see how you can vet somebody any better than that. And I'm talking for LA. I don't know what the other PDs do. The Los Angeles County Sheriff is the same, and many other PDs now are the same. And they also incorporate, lie detector tests, and now they're common. So I think that they're doing, as good as humanly possible in that aspect.
And you have the actual experience. So I'm curious, one of the things that I know you discuss is why you don't recommend it as a career choice to anyone. So like, what has changed with the police that you wouldn't recommend becoming one anymore?
Well, you know, for I can use the LAPD, that because I'm tied to that department. The city charter years ago had it was where the police commission actually conducted interviews within the hierarchy of the department to choose a chief of police. That way, the chief of police didn't have to kowtow to the mayor's political whims. And it was kind of bifurcated where the chief of police could manage his police department with, a lot of oversight, the city council, the city, the mayor's office, the, police commission, and on and on and on and on. But here some years ago, now it's the mayor that picks the chief of police. And so officers that screw up today, I mean, within an eye blink in Los Angeles, you're going to be thrown under the bus, period. End of story. Not to mention the way the mood is about our men and women in uniform. I mean, if you stop somebody today, you don't have you're not able to use that command presence, let me see your identification, your driver's license, what have you. Respect, not for the guy, but for the uniform and what it represents. Peace and order. And today they just, go screw yourself. And that leads to confrontations that ultimately, in some cases, the end result is dreadful. As I can't recommend that kind of work. I wouldn't recommend that kind of work. God bless those that do. But it's just, you're just cruising for a bruising today. It's crazy.
Yeah. So look, it's so wild, man. We could actually do a 3-hour podcast. So I want to kind of leave the floor to you. Like, if there's anything else you want to share, go for it. And then make sure, tell people about the book, website, and anything else you'd like to share. The floor is yours.
Well, I think that, there's a couple of reasons that I wrote LA's Last Street Cop. One is I wanted to get my story out because when you're fired, you're a dishonored person. I mean, they take your honor from you. And to me, that's my cornerstone. It means the world to me. I wasn't guilty for any of the events that that occurred at the Colorado River in the fight with the ex-con when he came at us with a shotgun. Now, pushing the murder suspect is improper. And if you wanted to, you know, punish somebody like that, normally your supervisor would come up, Al, knock that shit off. You don't touch these guys. I don't care what the hell he did. Okay, fine. You don't do it again, period. Yeah. But as to the incident at the Colorado River where this animal came at us with a, you know, started the fight, we defended ourselves, and, you know, and then for me blowing the whistle, so like I said, the first thing that I really wanted to do is give the public, and hopefully that it'll get picked up by some organization or news media of consequence who actually look at the facts and confront the, you know, the city council, the mayor's office, and the chief of police, and give me what they call a request for rehearing. And I've done that to every chief of police since I was fired in 1982. I've petitioned every chief of police. It's City Charter 202, subsection 16, called a request for rehearing. And I've done that to every chief of police, including mayors Villaraigosa and Garcetti. And I haven't, not even a text in return, because they know this thing is dirtier than hell. And you don't get a more honest, hard-working policeman than Al Moreno. You don't. And my record demonstrates that. You know, at the 5.5-year juncture, I had accumulated over 71 commendations. That's unheard of. And then as to use of force, I was complimented on one of the rating reports that Officer Moreno recovers more weapons than any other suspect, or I'm sorry, than more than any other officer in the crash unit, though has avoided an officer-involved shooting. So I'm just prouder than hell of my record. And the book gives a really unique insight into what our men and women do in uniform for them every day. And it's unlike any other story. You know, I'm talking LA Confidential, Serpico, and The New Centurion. I, to be very honest with you, I think it's better than any one of those movies. And it's all documented.
Yeah, no, it's... Your story is unbelievable, honestly. So look, thanks again for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Tyler, thank you so much for having me.
The Authors Unite show is sponsored by AuthorsUnite.com, your one-stop shop for becoming a profitable author and maximizing your impact.